Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Storytime with Brandon. My name is Brandon Patrick. Today on the show, we've got my good friend, Mr. Ben Kronberg. Ben is the host, owner, curator, mastermind, evil genius behind the Denver Comedy Lounge. Denver Comedy Lounge is my favorite venue in Denver. I love performing there. It's always a weird time, a wild time. And Ben is one of those guys where you meet him and you're like, I got questions, okay? I want to know your origin story. And we're going to get that origin story and a little bit more than we expected. Enjoy.
Like, I didn't know I was going to be a comedian.
Really?
I mean, I knew once it was happening,
yeah,
that's what I was probably going to keep doing,
yeah,
or hoping to keep doing. But it wasn't like I had a, you know, a thesis statement early on in life where I was like, I want to be a comedian.
Really?
Though I love comedians. Like, so I really like, you know, I really loved Andrew Dice Clay and Rodney Dangerfield, and I didn't get into like Richard Pryor or Bill Cosby till probably later. You know? More Eddie Murphy.
He's so great.
You know, I got in trouble one time in second grade or third grade for quoting the welfare joke. You know, your mom's on welfare, on the playground, right?
Yeah.
I was just repeating what I heard, and I knew it would be a cut down, you know, and I got in trouble for that, you know.
Oh man.
And so I guess maybe that was like an early onset seed of like getting attention for that sort of stuff, because kind of in high school I was maybe a class clown, not a class clown, but I was not a part of any group. I was friends with the band people, friends with the people in the football team.
You're not in either.
Yeah, not in any of those.
Tribeless.
Trying to be friends with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, a diplomat. And I think that kind of led me to, you know, I was always apt to try to make light of the situation because my dad, my mom probably taught me sarcasm, and my dad taught me like kind of raunchy, gross fart jokes, you know. And so, and I guess my dad would probably be more into like wordplay and the goofing around side of a comedy origin versus my mom. She was more sarcastic.
Okay.
I'm not going to say cynical, but I do have a joke about my mom because my parents got divorced. Like, this is an impression of my mom. This is my impression of my mom as a, telephone operator right after getting divorced. Grudges, can you hold, please? Grudges, can you hold? Grudges, can you hold? So basically this is a story about how I got a college agent.
Okay.
Because that's where I see the thing leading up to it. You know, me getting a college agent, which was the first thing that I think made me feel opened up and on part of the path of the career that I've stumbled upon. You know, like I said, I didn't want to be a comedian, but you know, the choices that you make lead you to one thing. One of the things that I started doing for work was working in restaurants, and mostly corporate chain restaurants like Maggiano's or Carrabba's Italian Grill. Things like that.
Serving,
bartending, busing.
Okay.
All of them. And then, you know, eventually I was able to move downtown. I went to film school in Boulder with the intention to make films.
Yep.
And then still kind of doing some editing, shooting when I moved to Denver. But then I had to get work because you got to get work. You know, like when I moved to Los Angeles, I had to get a job at Starbucks. So you got to get work. So I was like, well, I've been doing this, but there wasn't really any corporate restaurants downtown. So I ended up getting a job at this bar right by where I lived called the Park Tavern.
Okay.
And the Park Tavern was the place where, you know, it taught me how to drink.
Yeah.
Taught me how to drink at work, you know, like bringing shooters into the locker, you know, leaving my buster shirt in the locker, you know, kind of like this secret locker society of service industry. And you know, first day on the job, I got the person training me got me taught me how to get high in the handicap bathroom.
Okay.
And this is pre-legal weed. This is like early 2000s, like 2001, 2002.
And this is in L.A.?
Oh, this is in Denver.
This is in Denver. Okay. When did Denver get legal weed? 2014?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's been a while. It's been medical for a while, too.
Okay.
Even before that. But, so I started comedy in Denver. I was living in Capitol Hill, and it was like post 9/11. And right after 9/11, I started my last semester of college. My mom bought me a guitar, so I started, kind of learning the guitar a bit on my own. And then I would make up songs, play, just goof around songs. I wasn't trying to do any covers or any classics or figuring anything out too big musically, but just having fun. You know, living with roommate, Capitol Hill, smoking weed, strumming a guitar, making up songs, And weed is definitely tied to the creative pulling out element of, it stoked the fire of creativity for me for sure.
Yeah.
Smoking weed, like shifting up brain patterns, how you think about things, your observations of...
I like to do something sober and then smoke weed and do the exact same thing and just see how it resonates.
Mm-hmm.
I do that with albums a lot. Like, I'll listen to an album sober and I'm like, okay. You know? And then you get high and it's like, oh, this guy's on another planet. This guy's doing something.
You key into it.
Yeah. I used to think James Brown was not musical because he can't play an instrument.
Okay.
And like in music school, singers are kind of not respected.
Yeah.
I went to school for trumpet, and like singers were like, they didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And James Brown always struck me as the embodiment of knowing nothing of music.
Uh-huh.
But then like you start listening to him and the way he grunts and the way he like, he's the most musical thing there's ever been. You know what I mean? Like it just pours out of him.
Yep.
And an instrument would always hold him back, I feel like. I feel like it's better that he didn't. And he's got some piano albums that I would say don't check out. But.
Okay. Well, those make me even more curious.
Yeah.
Whenever you tell me don't, the contrarian comes out,
I'll let you borrow a couple. They're, it's weird.
Are they albums?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't have a record player.
Okay.
For the record, I don't have a player. I love James Brown. And I mean, I think that him being that, like, he's also a... the composer and conductor per se, right? Like he's the thing that brings everything else together that's kind of making and creating that sound. And the ego wants to separate and be the one that stands out. And I think we get that a lot in comedy where, because it is just us up there.
Yep.
But now running shows and sometimes, stepping away, not being on the shows, I'm seeing and noticing that I want the whole show to be good.
Yeah.
But I know as an individual comedian on the show, even though you know that, it's still kind of about what you're doing. So I think it's important to have somebody there that actually wants to see the whole show coming together, being good, being in the right order, good, the right vibe, and, knowing that every time is different, and, but that's also the beautiful thing about it.
Like, yeah.
Sometimes if you're too good at something or you're too... Or if something's too automatic, it becomes boring, or the complacency of enjoyment and other things happen. So it's interesting. And I don't know if, like, I think it was almost going to film school and wanting so much and tying myself up so much with it, then I didn't have enough sustainable longevity energy to see that really to completion.
Okay.
Or truly pursue that because I was actively pursuing it. Whereas comedy... I was kind of blindsided or presented with it in a way and coaxed in not by have to or even want to, but like, taste test it.
Yeah.
You know, come on back, y'all. You hear like this sort of siren. And, so I was working at this bar in Denver that was still like smoking inside and stuff. And they had an open mic on Tuesday that was like a music open mic. And there's this guy there, Garrett, who's a sound guy around town now, Oriental Theater and other places. He was the host of it, and he could really shred on the guitar, and he could play a lot of covers. He could do, 311 or Sublime. He did a lot of Sublime stuff,
Okay.
And I wasn't super comfortable playing and singing yet. I could do it by myself. But I was more comfortable in practice with this guy. I was like, you know, I want to try these songs or try one of these songs. And they were about 9/11 or about, like, Go to War, you know, or, you know, Ballad of the Jihad, which was like, you know, I don't know what you've been told, but anthrax is like the flu or cold. If I die, I hope it's from a stroke, heart attack, or a big-ass gun. Yesterday, I saw on the news a plane crashed and I refused to think that could happen to me. Oh, Lord, won't you hear my plea? It can't happen to me. No, it can't happen to me. Lord, won't you hear my plea? You said it can't happen to me. So that's Ballad of Jihad, kind of this paranoia song about that. You know, that for some reason I wrote it and I was definitely paranoid. Like, I thought there was a guy in my building who gave me some free beers and that was like anthrax because he was Middle Eastern. You know, I had this fucking xenophobic, fear-based fucking reaction to terrorism, and you know, now I lean more on the side of conspiracy than that. Not that I believe that this isn't a simulation. So that was my first like foray into just live performance, you know.
Yeah. Randy Newman-ish, like you know, listen to his music?
And that was a rendition of it. That wasn't exactly how it goes. That was mostly for lyrics, and the acapella version was slightly shifted. But I know it so well that I can do it.
You can
in different
do it any
tunes.
Style. Yeah.
Because that's what I do with my rap song that I'm do on stage, is I can kind of do it with multiple beats. Sometimes I can make it more singy, sometimes I can make it more rappy, but because I'm so familiar with it,
it's gonna come out.
Yeah. So I like, you know, I like that part of it, so that drew me into it, and then I was writing other songs about, you know, golden showers, or I want to go poop with you, or get your tubes tied, or, you know, very like dad's side of the brain.
Yeah.
You know, I get to talk about these things. I'm 21 years old. I'm in a bar drinking and smoking weed, and I can say these things, you know?
Yeah.
And which is funny because, like, you know, the thing that got me into it performing was the, you know, the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression, the being able to say whatever the fuck you want. And that was so liberating because that had always been stifled, like in school, right?
Yep.
Or around family, etiquette, fucking manners, and all that bullshit, that, you know, I at least had enough, like, my vocabulary was filled with curse words because my dad and mom would curse and stuff. They didn't necessarily want me cursing when I was younger.
Right.
And so then that was ingrained, even though I knew I could, and but I got more comfortable with that. So I was very comfortable around, my family wasn't stifling my speech at all.
Okay.
At one, you know, at some point. But it, you know, but school, you know, being outside of authority, you know, and being in this, like, you know, Mad Max sort of world of
it's like
of
a free fall
drinkers.
When you get out of, like, any sort of structure. Like, at college, it's kind of a sanitized version of the world.
Uh-huh.
Where there's
little
consequences for anything, you know.
Yeah.
You just write a paper.
Yeah, you're still
or whatever.
Protected by
yeah.
the thing. Yeah, you're still in this in some sort of system. There's they have their own police.
Yeah,
you know,
you're dumb enough to believe you can affect change by yourself.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, oh,
uh-huh.
I'm gonna go take arms and
uh-huh.
we're gonna get, it's like, no, man.
Uh-huh.
You're part of a much larger machine.
Yeah, yeah. In hindsight, I wish I hadn't gone to college. But had I not gone to college, in causality, had I not gone to college, I might not have gotten out of college and needed to find a job that wasn't what I was pursuing, but just something on the side. And that something on the side, I think going into those side doors or the alleys of life or things like that, that's where the fun, the interesting conversations happen. That's where I think the inspiration and stuff is. All the other things, like in the suburbs and stuff, that's so, like, guarded and protected and homogenized and, like, you know, out of sight, out of mind. They don't have to look at homeless people. They don't have to look at, you know, people that they're afraid of, nervous of, or whatever.
Different ethnicities.
Yeah, different.
Yeah.
All the things. And but I was always inclined to get out of that, you know, because I was raised in the suburbs. So this being in this bar, doing these songs. So another time I had, you know, started performing those funny songs, and somebody came up to me and was like, "Hey, you should do that at Comedy Works." and I was like, what? Never even contextualized the songs that I was doing at this open mic as comedy. So that was the thing. That was kind of like the, hey, you know, think about this. And then I was like, well, I'm doing this anyways. Maybe I should, you know, like, what else am I doing? So I investigated, did it, and felt the resistance of the hierarchy, pecking order of, you're coming into the fucking comedy cellar. You're coming into this place that, you know, you got to work your way up through. You got to know somebody. You got to be, you know, it's like, so figuring that out was very interesting. And then.
And you had no comic friends going into it? You just.
No.
Heard about it?
Yeah, and then I made comic friends at Comedy Works, and then consequently at the Squire. Because you could only get on at Comedy Works maybe once every 4 months and do 2 minutes, right, to start out. Okay. There's a little bit more fast-tracking. Luckily, it's gotten a little slightly looser these days. You know, some people have been able to move in from out of town and go right up to headlining, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, that wasn't the case for me doing this starting out. So then... end up doing that for a couple of months, and then the Squire starts up, and then, you know, comedy happens. It's another place to do the thing, and then that just kind of all feeds itself with music. Then I realize, oh, I should tell jokes. I shouldn't, you know, because the prop comic, you know, stigma of just doing guitar stuff.
Were you getting pushback from comics, like?
I mean, a little bit, but I think what I was doing was at least practiced and solid enough where I was representing myself, you know. I'm not going to say I was undeniable.
Yeah.
But there was something that I was like, you know, I mean, I was in choir and shit in like in junior high. So I had some singing background, but that wasn't necessarily, you know, and piano lessons early on in life and, you know, now a little guitar. So I had enough musical things to put it out there and at least have it sound good and be syncopated and stuff. And, but it was just fun and I just enjoyed it for the fun. And still, for the longest time, the first couple years, I'm only just, this is fun to do. This is a hobby. This is, you know, I see these people doing it professionally, but I still don't, I'm still not like, this is what I want to do.
You're still into film?
Yeah, I'm still trying, you know, doing some, like, video editing for, like, corporate bullshit. That was very fun and, you know, I was lucky to have it. But then, you know, then a contest comes up. You know, or certain things that make you think, like, do you have what it takes? Do you have what it takes? Throwing the gauntlet down. And, you know, so then, Comedy Works contests go up and I, you know, don't get past the first round with my songs, you know. And then the second year I try it again, don't get the, you know, I don't even think I make it past the first round again. Then I just keep doing it. Like, a lot of people are like, it's a discouraging thing to not keep making it forward. But I was getting other gigs and other encouragements. But then I ended up winning the third time that I tried it.
Whole thing.
Yeah. And that was like in 2005 was when I won the contest, I think. Hard to say. But that was a real big thing because I got got to go to Las Vegas, the Las Vegas Comedy Festival that most people have to pay to get into, and it's kind of a sham anyways, but it's still fun to do. And then, you know, just from that contest leading on to winning that, and then, you know, I ended up getting into, maybe with some confidence and momentum, getting into the Aspen Comedy Festival in 2007. And that was the last year that they had that festival. But that was the year that they had, like, TJ Miller, Kyle Kinane, the guy who's on Michel Buteau.
They brought out the headliner. They really brought it.
Like, this one was, I mean, these were when they were first discovered and kind of set into the scene. Like, you want John Mulaney was in that year.
Okay.
So it's like me, these other people, Michael Costa from, he's new on Daily Show.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people that are doing, like, you know, from that class doing really great things, right? And it's like, so that was a big thing to get. And that, so that led to getting a manager, got a really good manager at a really good company because they, you know, whatever, but they're just opportunists like everybody else. So they're just hedging their bets. So I got a manager out of that and Jimmy Kimmel out of that. you know, after having getting, you know, but I got a manager out of that, and he's like, well, you can move to New York or LA, but you should probably do one of those. You shouldn't stay in Denver. So I decided to move to LA. But I just want to do comedy at this point. I'm like, I want to do stand-up. But I get a manager, and they want you to, like, here, writing packet, write for this show. Let's go on auditions. And I'm like, all right, these are fun activities, but I really just want to do comedy. These other things would be cool, too, but I just fucking discovered I got momentum with this thing. Now I'm supposed to learn how to write a script. Now I'm supposed to learn how to act or
how many years into whatever. Stand-up did you win the contest?
I mean, I guess it was, like,
because the first year you're doing, like, guitar stuff.
Yeah, so guitar, I mean, I was probably got into Comedy Works around 2000, 2002, maybe 2001, 2002.
Okay.
And then, you know, months would go by. And I guess the contest might not have been, like, every year. I mean, it was every year, but maybe a little bit.
Maybe,
you know,
not in January every year. Maybe sometimes it's in June.
But yeah, I mean, I guess I would. I mean, I've been performing since I started doing music, but doing comedy probably 3 years, I guess.
Okay, wow. Was that time? Quick ascent.
Yeah, and I mean, I was young. I was youngish too. I don't know, 25. I don't know. You know, I don't know what I was. Graduated in spring of '99. That means I think I was at least 24, 25 when I started. So I remember my girlfriend being 4 years younger than me, and we started dating before I was doing comedy, and she was 19.
Okay.
You know, I don't know. The math, love math, comedy math, but like, and that's another thing too, right? Like keeping track of like how long you've been doing it, both, you know, sometimes trimming off the amount of years that you've been doing it, or sometimes boasting it, you know, like, you know, I would probably be more apt to pull back the number of years that I tell any given person who asks me versus like other people that wear their years with pride and like, you know, so that's an interesting psychology within comedy, you know, as a pause in the story, that I think had I been too willful and determined to become a comedian too early on, for me, that I wouldn't have been able to, that I don't know that I would have been able to handle or get, do the opportunities and milestones that had happened, because I'd be expecting things and hoping for things and being impatient and creating energy around this thing that needed to be fun for a long time before I could kind of take it seriously and activate it as a thing as opposed to just whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I think that in, you know, so everything that I seem to have gotten in comedy has been more, because I've, you know, definitely created many number of writing packets, number of auditions. So, you know, I've written some jokes for some people. I've gotten some, you know, commercially type work or co-starring roles in an MTV show one time or a thing, you know, things like that. But, you know, that I actually kind of auditioned or tried out for. But most of the coolest things that I've gotten haven't been from trying. It's just from literally being in the right place at the right time. Just the simplicity of going to Los Angeles or leaving the house to go to the bar or the Squire or the comedy club. Just leaving, just the simple task of it, not the trying to figure it out task of it. And I know that, I mean, everybody with, you know, with podcasts and sort of how comedy is a lot more popular and accessible now than it ever was. And, you know, and then once achieving milestones, feeling certain ways, but the journey to a place that you never thought you'd be and how you got there looking back on it, it's like, oh, so that's how you do, you know?
Yeah.
Because I couldn't have duplicated that, and you can't duplicate that, right? So that's a weird story or lesson of I mean, maybe there's a bit of Zen to it as far as the non-trying effort, right? Or something like that, like looking away to actually see what it is. You know, sometimes you have to do that. You have to look to the side of something to actually see, because right in front of you, it's too bright or so, you know, or something like that.
It's like when you're too close to the elephant, you can't see your, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, I was getting these things in comedy that led me to Los Angeles, that all these things happened, and being in Los Angeles, you're running into other comedians and have your kind of, you see who's out and about and who's there, and I remember seeing Nick Thune, you know, kind of on the internet and seeing his videos, and that he's already been on Jimmy Fallon, or he's already been on Conan, or some, you know, all these things, and doing things. And I notice also through a jealousy perspective that he's like, you know, he's like a guitar comic, and he does these one-liners, kind of like what I've developed into, and but he's very popular, so I kind of have like a watching him, you know, keep your enemies closer sort of thing.
Rivalry almost.
Rivalry,
Is it totally one-sided? Is he aware?
I don't know. Maybe not necessarily. I mean, the reason why he's not aware probably isn't for the same reason why you would even ask that. But
okay.
But he was, you know, somebody to have my eye on, because it was like something like what I was doing. Like I'd come to terms with like Dimitri Martin or Mitch Hedberg being one-liners or being deadpan or these things, because they are kind of inspirations, right? But here's somebody who is, not that I see necessarily as my peer, but somebody who is definitely like, oh, I want to do that.
Contemporary.
Like a contemporary. And but those contemporaries and in this position also keep you on your toes. You know, it's the people that inspire you by, you know, their deity status versus the people that fucking make you want to show up.
Yeah.
And so he did that, and then we ended up meeting in, I don't know, a party or something, and I think we had the same management company, so we were kind of in those modes. And I remember making friends with like one of his really good friends, kind of closer, like getting in with him more, and then just kind of getting comfortable. Well, you know, we ended up meeting and hanging out, me and Nick, and I don't even exactly remember where it was that we met, just because it's LA and it's little times here and there where you see each other, like you already kind of know the person because you've seen their comedy, but then, you know, when you finally first have that conversation, a real conversation. But he was really cool and really funny, and it was like, it was disarming too, because how I thought he was going to be or how I thought our interaction might be wasn't the case, you know? So it's just sort of like this constant repeated lesson of the futility of trying to predict what's going to happen in the future, how something's going to be. So we ended up making friends, and then he, you know, I think because we have the same agent or the same manager, he wants to go to, or he got a gig at the Las Vegas, or at the Los Angeles LA Comedy Club in Las Vegas at the Trader Vic's at the time in Planet Hollywood. And he asked me if I want to feature for him, but he doesn't want me doing any music in front of him, right?
Of course.
And I get it, you know, I don't want to double up. It's not like I'm going to advertise as a music show, but, you know, eventually we would team up on a big long tour documentary that was shot over a course of 15 days or more, that never saw the light of day. But anyways, so he invites me to do this, and I'm like, fucking cool. Like, this is kind of my first road gig, you know, and I'm feeling like, yeah, this is why I moved to LA. All right, now I'm, you know, my choices or my decisions to do these things are kind of paying off, and see where this goes. And so we get to go there. My dad lives in Las Vegas. At the time, he was living in Las Vegas. And so that was kind of cool, too. I could go to Las Vegas. My dad could see me perform, kind of all these things. And so my purpose is kind of like, oh, I'm building this relationship with this cool, popular comedian. I'm going to see my dad. These are kind of the reasons and in the forebrain of what's going on in Vegas. So I got to drive a lot, I think. We get some weed, legal weed, and, you know, in L.A. to drive it there, and, you know, it's cool. We got definitely plenty of weed to last us longer than just the weekend that we're there. And it's, you know, right now it's still pretty illegal in Las Vegas. It's not, you know, right now, currently it's nice, but but back then it was like not. And so we do these shows, and you know, they're pretty good shows. They there ends up being a couple agents there, a couple different agents, like what's his name? Doesn't really matter what their names are because they're fucking agents. It matters what our names are.
Yeah.
Our names are what matter. Well, Ron Easter, he's a really cool guy. And
he's my buddy's agent.
Okay, so
those are like some of the guys you want.
Yeah, so these guys are just in Vegas at the time gambling like they do.
On careers.
Like they can. Yeah, and careers in themselves and their lives and their things. And they know Nick, so they stop into the club to watch Nick. And so, you know, incidentally, they're seeing me too, and I'm like, oh, didn't see this coming. This is pretty fucking cool. You know, and I think I met him after the fact, so it wasn't all. I didn't feel like I was showcasing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they, you know, it was cool. And then after, you know, the show that they were at, we all went to this, you know, because we were with them. We got to this, up to this VIP section of this club in Planet Hollywood. And it's party and it's Vegas vibes. It might as well be a strip club, but it's not. But it has that vibe. Like, titties could come out at any time. And then next thing you know, the guy that we're with, who's probably some, you know, I don't know if he's Eastern European or something, but he had that fucking Vegas Jason Statham movie vibe.
Yeah.
And he pulls out a joint and he starts passing it around, and we're like, fuck, we got weed. Like, we think we're in VIP. We're thinking we're above the law, right? In this moment, we're just trying to win in Rome and fucking, okay, we're doing this. So we start fucking doing this. But to back up, one of the trips that was made, you know, after weed, but in Vegas, was Robert Gerson ended up hooking Nick up with some mushrooms and maybe some other things.
The guy was good for drugs.
So, you know, and we Nick ended up getting some mushrooms as well for that weekend. And so, you know, when you're leaving the hotel room in Vegas, you got to be ready, right? So you put everything in your pockets and you get the night ready because you're not going back to the hotel room till the morning or, you know, later. And so we're, you know, there. And so he's got all this stuff, but we're just, you know, smoking the weed right now. And there's probably people around doing cocaine, right? But that's just more like low key.
It's like a solo
But we're
endeavor.
Smoking like not, and this is pre vape pen stuff too. So we weren't vaping in there. We weren't like
You're smoking
vaping,
joints.
Smoking actual fucking flower. And so next thing you know, fucking we get surrounded by the security, the, you know, hotel sort of secret service. And then they surround us. And then the guy who started passing around the joint fucking bolts, runs out of there. And we're stuck there with the two agents, me and Nick. For some reason, all the other people that were there with us, like, escaped.
Of course.
But all of us, we got fucking taken down to the holding cell. And, you know, they're holding us there. And the guys were like, we're performing at this place. You know, we didn't know. This guy lit up a joint. We're just performing, you know. And you know, and then this guy, you know, they're kind of, you know, too much authority, too much swagger for the amount of authority, but they're probably still got pretty good authority. They're not cops though, and they haven't called the cops yet, but they're, you know,
they're letting you know that your fate is in their hands.
Yeah. And we're in there, and basically for some reason the agents, they proved that they, you know, maybe they weren't smoking or something, but they were there, and we were all there the whole time, and they're gonna pat us all down. So they're gonna pat us all down, try to find drugs, and they already caught us smoking weed. So Nick was like, "Here, let me just here's the one hitter that I got. This is just weed." But he knew that he had mushrooms on him, so he like, while they're whatever doing that, he slid off his jacket, you know. But basically, you know, while they were patting Nick down, I ended up farting. And so everybody in the room cracked up just because I farted a perfect fart at the right time. And so everybody, you know, the agents laughed, the fucking actual security laughed. And that kind of, I think, provided the distraction and, again, the disarming moment for for them to kind of be like, all right, well, you're not allowed back in here, you know, kind of just like slapping us on the hand because they didn't check his jacket. They just checked his body, you know?
And
so this event happened, and it's like, fuck, okay, at least I didn't get in trouble. Like, it's just fucking adrenaline. This is a gig, but it didn't feel the worst, but I don't know fucking Vegas rules, you know? I've gotten pulled over in Utah with weed, and I had like less than a gram in this car. We got pulled over in Utah, and I got like a Class B misdemeanor, $555 fine, got arrested. Got taken back to the, you know, police station. I didn't get thrown in jail, but blah, blah, blah. But they just wanted their money. But I knew, so I didn't know how illegal it was, but we ended up getting off, kind of got in trouble by the club because they're like, what the fuck are you doing? I get it, but you know, it's also weed. It's Las Vegas, really. That's the worst thing, you know, like in perspective. It didn't feel bad morally.
It could have gone so differently.
So that happened, and then, you know, we end up, you know, playing out the weekend, and it was ended up fine, and we had something to talk about on our way back to Los Angeles. And then next thing I know, I get hit up by TJ Mark Walter. I didn't get hit up by him. I basically got hit up by his girlfriend, who was a college agent. And so I'm getting randomly hit up by her, and she's like, yeah, I've heard about you through Ball Crown Major. He met you, saw you at the Vegas Comedy Club, and said that you'd be good for this, you know, maybe good for doing colleges. And I was like, shoot, I don't know. Because she was like, yeah, he told me the story of what happened.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, and I think it was, like, the fart, my set.
It's like, this guy's funny, and then it's like, this guy oozes comedy. This guy is...
Yeah, like, he saw my set, but it was the fart that made him remember me.
Yeah.
And that's what she told me. It was like, she's like, he remembered you because you were this guy that farted. And so, I got a college agent because I farted.
That's crazy. That's the perfect fart.
Yeah. So that's the end of the story. But, I mean, it's kind of like a thing of milestones, but that was my first milestone that allowed me to do what I wanted to do, even though college gigs are not the best gigs.
It's a very shiny, you want
to
do them.
But it allowed me to start making money doing comedy.
Yeah.
And making pretty good money for not working very hard and traveling around and seeing the country and setting up other shows in these places. And it, you know, one thing kept leading to another. You know, colleges, starting to do colleges, that led me to moving to New York. You know, so it just sort of like that, you know, because once I was traveling around, I could meet, you know, visit friends.
Yeah.
And so then I was like, okay, New York. Now I got to be in New York. And then New York laid out opportunities for me. But, you know, outside of, you know, but my agents really didn't get me much. I mean, the college agent got me a little bit. She got me the opportunity to give money to NACA, to give money to apply to NACA with my tape.
Yeah.
Which luckily, I mean, I had some credits, so it enabled me to present with some credits. And, you know, it wasn't as affirmative action or trying to be diversity. So me being a white male comedian at that point didn't hurt the worst.
Yeah.
Though over the course of doing colleges for, you know, a couple, 3 years, as things started going and my whatever, that faded away. But then that led into other things, you know? Okay. So it's like, but I think getting the college agent was a thing that made me feel like I was, in that moment, made me feel like, okay, I'm a comedian. I'm doing comedy. Because I hadn't gotten any other comedy living in LA. I hadn't gotten, for 2 years, I didn't have an agent booking me gigs.
You're doing just open mics and coming out. And,
yeah, or trying to get on the cool shows if I could.
Can you bring me to someone's? Yeah.
Yeah. Which is fine, but it was like, okay, now I got to work at Starbucks. Now I got to do these things. And getting that college agent allowed me to not worry, work at Starbucks or anything like that, which is cool.
Do you still do colleges?
No, I haven't. I haven't done one in a number of years.
I remember seeing, it's so weird how they do them now. It's like, if you're super famous, you can just get away with whatever you want.
Yeah.
Come in, be filthy, talk about what. We had Doug Benson at our college one time. And he was like, I'm high as fuck, man. And it's like, wow. And I remember I did a campus open mic, and I mentioned sex, and they were like, you're banned from the campus
open. And I was like, yeah, the irony of those things at colleges where they're like, yeah, you want to expose people to all this knowledge, but yet you want to censor the one thing that they might actually light a fire in them.
Yeah.
Or give them the release that comedy provides. Like, it's like a, but everybody, it's the bureaucracy of the thing, and everybody's afraid of getting in trouble or lawsuits, and that's the problem with education. That's why learning on YouTube is so much better, because you don't have to worry about lawsuits. You know?
My fear, I learned on...
The internet doesn't have an HR department.
No, it doesn't. The thing I fear about learning stuff on the internet is, like, I know... I don't get to ask questions. I'm, like, a question guy. Like, mm-hmm. Like, when I do music, when I'm approaching, like... I'm trying to get really good at funk. Like, I want to be a really good funk musician. But as a secret. Like, I don't want anyone to know that I'm good at it until I'm great at it.
Uh-huh.
I don't want anyone to see this thing getting built.
Okay.
Except for my roommates, who are just probably absurdly annoyed with. Man, I have 3 different horns that sound insanely different, and they just never know which one I'm gonna pick up. You know? I have a marching baritone now, that's like. It sounds like a tuba,
uh-huh.
And it's just this wah. And I'm not good at it, you know, because I haven't played low brass in over a decade and a half. I'm, like, building my chops,
uh-huh.
But I'm also, like, I want to do funk riffs. So I'm trying to do these funk riffs on this instrument that I have no aptitude for.
It's like, but if you have the goal of the funk riff, I think that you'll find you'll find the funk. I mean, you always find the funk. The funk always finds you.
That's what it is. That's what it is, man. And it's just, like...
If you leave your socks on long enough, you'll find the funk. If you play your sax long enough, you'll find the funk.
It's one of those things where it's like, I hope they don't think I'm just fucking around to be annoying. You know? But, like, I'm in no hurry to let them hear my music. You know what I mean? Like, I record songs all the time. I'll send them to you or...
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, what do you think? And you're like, it's okay. And then I'm like, all right, delete.
I didn't say it's okay. I've never said it's okay.
No, you've never said it's okay. You've given good praise.
Yeah.
But I've never...
I mean, don't delete something based on my response.
I delete it no matter what. Like, I...
Well, it's still on my phone.
Well, there it is. It lives where it lives.
Yeah.
That was Ben Kronberg. I am Brandon Patrick, and this is Storytime with Brandon. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next week, we've got an awesome episode for you. But hey, let some shit out. Like some farts, you know? It can lead to wonderful things, as we just heard. Let some shit out. I'll see you next week. Goodbye.